Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And coming up, a look ahead at what next week may hold in the Samuel Alito confirmation proceedings, including confirmation. But first, beginning 30 days from now, Walmart will be required to spend more on health care for its employees in Maryland, making Maryland the first state to pass a law forcing private enterprise to offer enhanced health care benefits. The legislation passed last night over Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich's veto. It applies to all companies employing over 10,000 workers and was spearheaded by a strong labor lobby, which maintains that Walmart's full-time employees couldn't afford the company's health care plans and were turning up on the state's Medicaid rosters in unprecedented numbers. Andy Green covers Walmart for the Baltimore Sun. He joins us on the line from the State House there in Maryland. And Andy, start by telling us, what exactly is this new law?
Sure, Robin. As you said, it applies to all companies in Maryland with more than 10,000 employees and requires them to spend at least 8% of their payroll on employee health care. If they don't, they have to pay the difference to the state for Medicaid programs.
So they have to put money into the Medicaid fund?
Essentially, yes. There are four companies in Maryland with that many employees. Walmart, of course, Northrop Grumman, Johns Hopkins University, and Giant Foods, the grocery store chain. Three of them do provide more than 8%. Walmart does not.
Well, how does Walmart respond to this criticism? This is one of the wealthiest companies, run by one of the wealthiest families in the world. What do they say to people who say their health plan is stingy?
Well, they've been pretty defensive about this over the last several months. You probably saw the stories this fall about an internal Walmart memo that came out in which they admitted that their health care plans are too expensive for a lot of their workers. So they have taken some steps to try to make more affordable plans for their workers, but a lot of people on the other side think that's just window dressing and that they're engaged in sort of a PR campaign to try to get themselves out of it. But Walmart says, you know, if you're an employee of this company, you can become eligible for health care. The question, though, is whether those plans, considering how little many Walmart employees make, are really feasible for a family to afford.
Well, we understand, as we said, Governor Robert Ehrlich previously vetoed the law that passed last night. And when he did veto it, a Walmart executive was sitting right by him. There's a new store in the state at stake.
A new distribution center, actually, would be on the eastern shore of Maryland in a fairly economically depressed part of the state. I mean, Maryland's economy is generally very good, but this is in a more rural area. Unemployment there is about twice the statewide average, and it would bring nearly 1,000 relatively good-paying jobs to the lower eastern shore, you know, $12 an hour or thereabouts. And Walmart has taken some pretty big steps back from their commitment to build this distribution center since this bill has been going down the tracks here in Maryland.
Do the governor and other lawmakers worry that this new law will discourage business from coming to Maryland?
Oh, absolutely. This has been the governor's main line of attack, is to say, you know, how am I supposed to attract companies to this state when the legislature is out there effectively passing a tax on one company?
Is that realistic?
Hard to say. I mean, Maryland's economy, as I said, is going very well, in large part because of our proximity to Washington, and we've got a lot of biotech and things like that. There are certain advantages here that it's hard to imagine companies will pass it up. But, you know, on the other hand, the business groups are really very worried about this.
Well, and I'm wondering, are other states watching?
Oh, absolutely. The AFL-CIO has made this a major national push, and it was really catching on even before they got involved. There are likely to be bills very similar to this introduced in about 30 or more states this year. But really, even before last night's vote, other states had been looking at Walmart. You know, several states, including Georgia, Tennessee, Washington, had passed laws that enabled them to see how many of a certain company's employees are showing up on their Medicaid rolls. And by gosh, they found that Walmart was putting a lot of employees on their rolls, or their children, or their husbands, their wives, whatever. So people have been eyeing this for a while, and the momentum is expected to pick up after last night's vote.
Andy Green, he covers Walmart for the Baltimore Sun and is speaking to us from the Maryland State House after last night's legislation that will force Walmart in about 30 days to pay more for health care for its employees there in Maryland. And Andy, one last question, a victory for the Walmart workers, but is there fear that this will open up the door for other state regulation of health care spending, or is it thought that this is just restricted to Walmart?
Well, the fact that it's restricted to Walmart made it much easier to pass, I think. But a lot of opponents to this bill say they think this is the first step in a slippery slope, that, you know, next year it's not going to be companies with 10,000 employees, maybe it'll be companies with 5,000, and maybe next year it won't be 8%, maybe it'll be 10% or 12 or so on.
Andy Green, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Senate confirmation hearings for Judge Samuel Alito are expected to wrap up today. The vote on his nomination is scheduled for sometime next week, and confirmation appears likely, despite indications that most Democrats will oppose the nomination. There are few signs of Democrats mustering either the votes or the energy for a filibuster. To help us reflect on the hearings and look ahead to a possible confirmation and a court possibly soon without moderate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, I'm joined by two guests, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And good to have you as always. And David Barron, a professor at Harvard Law School. He has advised Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee on Alito and John Roberts as well. He joins us here in the studio. David, welcome.
Thank you.
And Gail, you sat through the hearings this week, unlike most Americans who only peeked in. Give us your general impressions.
Well, it was a long, very focused, intense, and almost flat-lined hearing, if you can imagine all those coexisting. Mm. The fact that so much time was spent talking about issues like Vanguard recusal or what, I guess more significantly, what Sam Alito belonged to in Princeton and what he was proud of in later life, and not as much on 15 years of a judicial record on the court of actual decisions he made that had a difference in people's lives. That was greatly disappointing, I think, to many of the interest groups that were watching. They had expected, after building up for this hearing, for some of them more than a decade, that the hearing would really turn on his record and on issues like, you know, how does he rule on civil rights cases? How does he rule on, there was a lot of discussion about abortion, but how does he rule on decisions that are going to make a difference in people's lives? And I think to these groups, it was a very disjoint result and very unsatisfying because we don't really know much more about this man at the end of the hearings than we did going into them.
Well, of course, his supporters would say he answered, let's see, somebody did the math, hundreds of questions. More than 700. And he was battered at times by Democrats. But David Barron, your thoughts. Do you have the same feeling as Gail that there could have been more questions about record?
I have a slightly different take. I think it's extremely hard in the setting of a hearing to go through a sitting judge's record by asking him about the details of particular cases. Because what the experience of the Roberts hearing shows, and I think to the extent that they did press Judge Alito on his own past decisions also shows, is that he's likely to just essentially repeat what he wrote in the opinion that's at issue. And the more you press him on it, he'll, of course, know an extra precedent or an extra fact that the senator couldn't possibly know given the thousands of decisions that are out there. And so it becomes a little bit of a fruitless exercise, and it becomes, I think, to some extent, less illuminating. And the consequence is that the Senate, I think, who are concerned about him tend to pull back from that record and try and get at the heart of what is the actual philosophy that's driving this man outside of the weeds. And an indication of that can often be found in writings that aren't in a particular case, such as the writings that were at issue from the memos when he was in the Justice Department.
Well, I was going to ask about that because it does seem about trying to shape a sense of who this person is, and even if he's likable at some point. And Gail, you know, the Democrats and many of Judge Alito's foes had tried to present him as some real threat from the far right, or at least from the very conservative right. How did he come off? Is there a way of defining how he came off?
Well, he came off certainly as steady. You know, one of the descriptions someone used about him, which I liked, was a flat-line performance, not meaning that he was dead, but that there just wasn't much variation. The only variation really came from his family when his wife had to leave the room I think, struck by the sympathy that one of the Republican senators, Senator Graham, exhibited and the battering that she felt that her husband had taken on ethical issues.
By the way, Gail,
whether or not he was bigoted.
Do you think that that affected the Democrats? You were in the room. Did it affect the questioning the next day, the fact that Alito's wife had burst into tears?
Let me take a brave leap on this one. I know that the television coverage suggested it did. A lot of people led with that the next day. But if you look at the transcript and look at the questions that were raised, I don't really think it meant a lot to the media and to the coverage, but I don't think it touched much of the substance of the case. I mean, we know that it's hard on families. We know, and I think Senator Kennedy made a point at the end of his last round of questioning, to say, I hope your family understands that there are big issues at stake here, and that's why we basically are as rough as we are. But they continue to talk about Vanguard. They continue to talk about concerned alumni of Princeton. It was a way of trying to introduce into the debate some questions about how the character of this man and whether you could really trust him on the court to keep to the commitments he appeared to have made to the senators.
Speaking of the character, so how did Judge Alito, you mentioned, you know, somewhat flatlined and some would say dull, but how did he emerge as a character, first Gail Shattuck and then David Barron?
Well, one thing I appreciated about him was that he did not immediately jump to the judicial equivalent of the Fifth Amendment. I cannot answer this question because it's an issue that's likely to come before the court. He did actually talk a lot before he finally got to some answer like, I cannot answer this question because it's likely to come before the court. So you got some insight into how he reasons through issues, and I think he came across as steady and very strategic.
David Barron?
I think Gail's hit on a very useful word in understanding Judge Alito, and that is the word strategic. I think if you look back at his performance in the Justice Department, as many of the senators pressed him on, one of his signature approaches to moving the law, and it was clear then, at least, that he was quite committed to moving the law, was to take a strategic approach to doing so. It wasn't to just say, here's my principle, that's the end of it, love it or leave it. It was, how are we going to actually get this court to move? What's the strategic way to move the law to the right? And I think what came across to me is that he continues to be a relatively strategic man. If you compare his 1985 job application and the things he highlighted to the Justice Department to get into the Reagan administration, I like the Goldwater campaign. I wrote for National Review. I believe personally that abortion does not exist in the Constitution. And you compare his opening statement to the Senate hearings. My father was very committed to civil rights and justice. I have a very open mind. It's a very different story. And not that they're incompatible necessarily, but it's a different self-presentation. And I think there was a strategic dimension to it. The last thing I'd say is, unlike Judge Roberts, he really does not show himself to be a lawyer's lawyer. Much more, I think, he's rooted in an ideological position.
That's David Barron, professor at Harvard Law School. We've also been speaking with Gail Shattuck of the Christian Science Monitor. When we come back, is it too soon to say Justice Alito? And what is a court like without a moderate Sandra Day O'Connor? We'll take a look at all of that when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're continuing our conversation about the Alito confirmation hearings. A confirmation vote is scheduled for sometime next week. We've been speaking with Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, and David Barron, professor at Harvard Law School. He's advised Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee and clerked for Justice Stevens at the Supreme Court. So, David, sort of wearing your allegiance there on your sleeve just a little bit, but I want to start with you because many of the analysts are saying today that Judge Alito's views are far closer to those of Justices Scalia and Thomas than to Justice O'Connor, whose seat he'll be taking if confirmed. What does that mean to you in the very near future? Because it could be in the very near future.
Well, the most dramatic backdrop to the hearings is the broad assertion of presidential power in connection with the war on terror by the Bush administration. And the really extraordinary feature of that backdrop controversy is that the president is actually picking two members of the court, that's quite likely to be the only real check on those assertions of power. And so in the near term, there will be cases coming to the court concerning the constitutionality of the president's use of military tribunals, potentially the constitutionality of the president's assertion of this broad right to engage in some domestic surveillance. And the judges on that court are judges that he himself has chosen, namely the Chief Justice John Roberts and, as we expect, Justice Sam Alito. Now, each of them has taken broad views of presidential power. Roberts, in a prior decision, and actually a decision that was likely to lead him to recuse himself from the military tribunal case, and Judge Alito, in his writings in the Justice Department, and then in the year 2000 speech to the Federalist Society, in which he endorsed a very broad view of executive power.
Yeah, and Gail Chadwick, those topics were touched on in the questions this week. What do you get from that?
Well, I would add one more to it that was even more alarming to members on both sides of the aisle, and that is the president's signing statement after he signed the Defense Appropriations Act, which had an amendment in it about a congressional prohibition of torture. Now, this was something that the Bush White House had resisted very strongly. They said they'd veto any bill that had this on it. But in the end, the vote was so strong in both the House and the Senate that the president compromised. There was a photo op. He signed the bill. But with it, he added this signing statement, something none of us think about, signing statements. Kind of these trivial things you don't pay attention to. But in the Bush White House, they're very important. Because this statement, in effect, said, I've signed the bill, however, I'm claiming exemption for myself and anyone I care to include in this by virtue of executive power, unitary executive. Congress was outraged at this, and they haven't been in session since the signing statement, so we haven't really heard the floor statements yet, but there's a lot of concern about it. And the judge was pressed at several points on how he felt about that. Well, the fact is he helped draft the thinking on signing statements in the Reagan administration. And in response to that, he said, well, I did that when I was a staff lawyer. But the fact that as a judge in front of the Federalist Society just a few days after the 2000 election, he restated this theory is of great concern. And I think you're going to see it come up in the confirmation vote even more aggressively than it did in the hearings, because this is something that Republicans as well as Democrats want settled and care a lot about.
Well, in fact, David Barron, he was also asked about President Bush's decision to authorize wiretapping of Americans, and he wasn't very specific in that arena either.
Yeah, I think appropriately so, in the sense that I think it is a case that's likely to come before him, and I don't think it would be appropriate to directly say how he would rule on that. On the other hand, I think what is giving concern to a lot of people, both within the Senate and outside of it, is that if you look at the president's nominees to the Supreme Court this past few months and over the course of the year, there's one common denominator between John Roberts, Harriet Myers, and Judge Alito, and that is all were lawyers for the president, and that was a foundational experience in their legal background. All in that capacity and beyond that capacity stated very strong views about the authority of the president to exercise broad powers. John Roberts, as a judge, upheld the military tribunals. And now Judge Alito, as Gail just said, in the year 2000, restated a position that had been dear to him about the scope of executive power. And I think what gives concern is that it seems that beyond abortion and other matters, if there is an agenda to move the constitutional philosophy of the country in the Bush administration, it's one that takes a very broad view of executive power. And the concern is that he's now going to have a court that he's helped shape that will be quite sympathetic to that view.
By the way, David Barron, how is there a precedent for that, all the nominees being lawyers for the president?
Well, it's a great question. As I look back on it, I can't think of a circumstance, at least going back to Roosevelt, which as far back as I've really thought it through, in which that's been the case. That's not to say other presidents haven't picked nominees who are lawyers for the president, but they've never exclusively done so. If you look at President Reagan, of course, Justice Scalia was a lawyer to the president. He worked in the Office of Legal Counsel, but he also nominated Justice O'Connor, who had never worked in the executive branch at all and was a state legislator. If you look at President Clinton, neither of his nominees were lawyers for the president. Justice Breyer had actually worked in the Senate, is his foundational experience, and Justice Ginsburg, of course, was both an academic and a lawyer in private practice.
Gail, jump in there. Make your point.
Just a P.S., remember this president has 3 more years.
And Gail, in the minute and a half that we have, given these, you know, a couple concerns that have just been raised, what do you think? Is it going to be clear sailing in the confirmation vote?
The math is overwhelmingly in favor of this nomination at this point. Had something drastic happened in the hearings, perhaps not, but I'm hearing very little. No one has committed themselves about a filibuster yet, but even if it happens, I think the Republicans have the votes to block it.
And the vote, as we said, scheduled for sometime next week. Well, that's Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, who finally has been released from the hearing room. She's been there all week, poor thing. David Barron, a professor at Harvard Law School, has advised Democrats in these hearings proceedings. I want to thank you both, and we look forward to next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The talk of the town in New Orleans this week can be summed up in 2 words, footprints and levees. A mayoral commission unveiled its plan for rebuilding the city after Hurricane Katrina. That plan has the potential to dramatically shrink the footprint of the city by letting some of the worst hit areas return to marshland. Meanwhile, President Bush visited yesterday. He acknowledged that the cleanup process has been slow, but said he was impressed by some pretty dynamic changes since he last visited. He also complained that Congress had not funded half of the $3 billion he requested to rebuild the levees. Well, for more on the past week and a look ahead at what the future holds for New Orleans, we turn first to Jason Berry, an author and journalist in that city. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And first of all, Jason, we've been seeing and hearing a lot of angry people from New Orleans this week in the news. How did people respond to the president's visit?
The most interesting item I saw was that the Academy of the Sacred Heart took its entire student body of young ladies to Jackson Square. This is an old blue blood establishment, a very fine school, convent school. Most of the parents surely supported Bush. And here are these young ladies out there not protesting against the president, but calling for Category 5 levee protection.
Yeah, let's talk more about that, because the Army Corps of Engineers plans to meet its goal of restoring the levee system to pre-Katrina strength by June 1st, that's the start of the hurricane season. But, you know, people are saying, well, pre-Katrina strength, that may not be enough.
That's absolutely true. In fact, the most interesting plan that is sort of coming forth now is a comparison, you might say, with what the Dutch have done over the years in preventing flooding in Holland. In fact, this week, the two senators, Mary Landrieu and David Vitter, have been in Holland with Governor Kathleen Blanco studying the system. It's a very elaborate flood defense system with gates and monitored channels and so forth, far superior to anything we have here. If the levees are restored, for example, to the strength that they were, say, in June of last year, any kind of Category 3 hurricane would flood the Ninth Ward and parts of New Orleans East.
And people have said, though, that they wouldn't want to move back home under those conditions.
Well, that's the problem. Like everyone, I want the Bring New Orleans Back Commission to find a good balance here. But I think many people, understandably, look, I live in a house that did not flood. I'm one of the 28 or 30% of the people in the city who didn't incur that kind of damage. But so many people who are desperate to rebuild have been tossed in this political limbo. First, the mayor said that there would be a four-month period where people would have to wait. Then he backed off. So there's been quite a good bit of confusion, and I must say a vacuum in political leadership, in my view.
Well, and just to touch on that four-month moratorium, and we talked about the changing footprint of the city, a lot of people are saying that that's code for poor African-American neighborhoods are going to disappear.
That's true, but it would also encompass some of the more affluent neighborhoods like Lakeview and Eastover, which is in New Orleans East. Personally, I detest the idea of the footprint. I think it's a terrible metaphor, but it's what we're stuck with right now. And, you know, this is political engineering of the first rank, and it is bound to create divisions, and we're already seeing those stark cleavages.
Boy, divisions. I mean, we're thinking of some of the heated debate we've heard. One person telling a commission member that he hated him. Some people say this is a land grab for developers. It's pretty heated.
It is heated. I'm not sure I would call it a land grab, although the one thing that really concerns me is President Bush's failure to get behind the bill that has been proposed by Congressman Richard Baker from Baton Rouge, which would essentially create a public development corporation to buy out people who have had flooded homes. And then, if they have enough insurance to go with what the corporation, the public corporation, would provide them, they in turn would be able to buy back their homes to rebuild. It's a pretty enlightened plan, and Bush has dodged it, which is, I think, one of the most unfortunate things about this continuing quagmire.
Jason Berry, New Orleans author and journalist, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Well, while the mayor of New Orleans, Mayor Nagin, still has to give the green light to the proposal to rebuild New Orleans, members of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission are moving full steam ahead. Local architect Ray Manning has the unenviable job of heading the urban planning project to the next level. He joins us now. And Ray, first of all, how tough is your job? Because it seems as if, you know, you just can't please everybody.
No, you can't. And we have to be very careful about the words that we use. As an example, the word moratorium may not have been the most appropriate word to use in terms of what's going to happen over the next 4 months. But we really need the patience of the community at this point to allow us to go through this process. Everyone who has been involved in this, I believe, has a strong love for this community. And you wouldn't have thought that listening to the comments at the meeting the other day. And there's a lot of distrust. The first thing we have to do is all collectively take a deep breath and truly trust one another that we're not here to take advantage of the poor in our community. And so much is expected of us. And so we have a real responsibility to this community.
Well, how do you get residents to participate in these groups if so many of them are spread all over the country?
One of the things that's being considered is that we will have some town hall meetings in other cities. We recognize that many of our citizens are in Houston, Atlanta, and certain metropolitan areas can be reached if we can get some cooperation from FEMA to get addresses and phone numbers in those particular metropolitan areas where we have large concentrations of former New Orleanians.
Ray, what do you say to people who believe that they are former New Orleanians, that their communities are already doomed, are going to be turned back to marshland?
Well, I would hope that everyone would give this committee and this work effort an opportunity to engage in a conversation. Perhaps we can remove some of the distrust that has developed over this period.
Ray, if you could just briefly for us before we let you go, what do you envision? Smaller city, taller buildings? What is there something that's forming in your head?
I don't want to preempt the process, but certainly there are some very significant issues. Obviously, the repair of the levee system is the number one priority. The levee system had not failed, we would not have had as much destruction in the city. And also, I believe that we have an opportunity to develop, perhaps in some areas that have been up until now, been reluctant to create some density in those areas, to go ahead and make some decisions to do that. Along our riverfront, we have a wonderful riverfront here in New Orleans with many attractions, the Aquarium of the Americas and the Waldenburg Park. I would like to see a further development of that riverfront with more intense density, with residential, retail, mixed-use development along the riverfront.
Ray, thank you.
Thank you.
Ray Manning is a New Orleans architect. He's working with the Bring New Orleans Back Commission to develop a plan for rebuilding that city. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we almost made it. We almost got Mom into a nursing home. But just before Christmas, she took a disastrous fall. She died 7 days later. Some of you know I've been caring for my mom long distance for a while now, navigating a bewildering maze of dementia and health care coverage. There was a group of us, actually, home aides and geriatric care doctors, my brothers and sisters, Mom's grandkids, and a saintly boyfriend. Together, we were the flying Walendas of elder care, keeping Mom aloft. Now I feel as if I missed a catch, and my arms are so empty. But I've learned so much. So if you don't mind, what follows is one last dispatch from the elder care front. I've spoken here about Mom's heart attacks, her dementia, but she was delightful and far too independent for a dementia ward in a nursing home. What to do? Live-in aides cost up to $80,000 a year, and after Mom's private insurance company went under, she had only Medicare and little savings. So we applied for Medicaid, a program that's different in every state. Luckily, in New York, Medicaid pays for full-time live-in home health aides at a fraction of the cost to the state, by the way. Mom qualified. An angel from Ghana named Akusia Darkoa moved in, and it worked great for about a year and a half. But it became impossible for us to handle what we came to call the night terrors. After dark, Mom would rage at demons only she could see, or continuously call for her mother in a voice so frightened it broke your heart. This despite strong drugs. In hospitals, they call it sundowners or delirium. At sunup, she'd smile and become sweetly childlike again, as if the wreckage of the night before had never happened. Towards the end, I was traveling from Boston to give the exhausted and heroic Akusia a break. I made it a kind of devotion. I'd get up, guide her back to bed, then lay down for a minute, then do it all over again, all night. Of course, we'd come full circle, because as a mother of four infants, this is what Mom did for years. Finally, the time came to find a nursing home here in Massachusetts, a whole new bewildering terrain. New York officials said Medicaid coverage was transferable. It was not. We'd have to reapply. Also, not all nursing homes accept Medicaid patients, and very few had beds available. I found elder care consultants and a company called A Place for Mom, which is free to families, and acts as a middleman between nursing homes and seniors. I learned that if I offered to pay privately for a room for Mom for a month or so, around $8,000 a month, by the way, a bed would probably become available. And it did. We were driving to see it when the call came that Mom had fallen. She walked out the front door. The front door! We'd put extra locks on the basement door, but not the front door. She fell off the stoop and hit her head. We spent days in the hospital. My sister curled up beside her. We held her hands so she wouldn't have to be restrained. We held our breath. She had bleeding on the brain and soon stopped eating. Her doctors explained that inserting a feeding tube was an option, but the surgery could be too much for her. But it didn't matter. I'd promised Mom no tubes. All of her children were either on the cell phone or in the room the night she died. My brother sang the songs they sang together when he was a kid, the Lord's Prayer and If You Were the Only Girl in the World, and then she was gone. Over the last 2 years, people would say, why don't you take a break, or this must be such a burden? Turns out the opposite is true. It's not that Mom and I always had a storybook relationship. There were issues, and they'll be plumbed privately. She was a kind, generous, educated woman buffeted by the gin-soaked 50s. She had 7 kids in all but lost 3 in childbirth at a time when women were told, be happy, you have a dishwasher. While I leapt into the women's movement, she was divorced into it, unwillingly and woefully underprepared. There were times when I was impatient with Mom, but now I don't know how she held it together as long as she did. And here's the thing. Over the last 2 years, I fell in love with my mom all over again. I tell you this in case there's anything you can glean from it. In the end, what I learned is you can rail at the overloaded, underfunded elder care system. You can lock all the doors. You can build a moat. But you can't keep out the thief in the night. Really, no thief at all, but a compassionate end to the night terrors. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. For 2 years, Anna Marie Cox had Washington's ear, or rather eye. The Washington Post called her political blog Wonkette, Politics for People with Dirty Minds, a must-read. Now Anna Marie has left the blogosphere for the bookstore. Her first novel is called Dog Days. It's centered around a presidential campaign and a highly provocative website, Capitolette. Let's listen to a reading where the heroine, Melanie, a campaign staffer, is musing about the nature of blogs and how they impact political campaigns.
She was fascinated by the blogosphere, though she had a hard time explaining why. She was unsure of how to summarize the adolescent, pseudo-sophisticated political sandbox that she had been observing with interest, mostly because it was her job. The fringiness of political bloggers made the internet a kind of extreme focus group for new ads and new tactics. Their reactions wouldn't tell you how the country as a whole would react, but it was a way to take the temperature of the base. To do that, however, you did have to wade through pages and pages of text devoted to petty rivalries and to gleefully misinformed strategy memos on what the campaign should do next. There's something quaint and stupid about all the time bloggers put into these deconstructions.
Well, Melanie herself creates the blog Capitolette in order to... I'm getting ahead of myself. Dog Days author Anna Marie Cox joins us in the studio now with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Quite a transition. When did you decide to go blog to book?
It was actually, there's an opening scene in the book that takes place at the last night of the Democratic Convention in Boston. And while it is mostly fiction, I would say that opening chapter is probably the most reality-based.
Because what? What did it...
Because I was at this party at the Four Seasons here in Boston, and everyone from, you know, John Edwards to the ratty assistant to the speechwriter whose main job is to get water for people, like, we're there. And everyone's putting everything on someone else's tab, and people sort of, you know, whispering about each other, and people trying to make deals and trying to get into bed with someone. And it just seemed to me like the perfect snapshot of the craziness and the energy of a campaign.
It's either synergy or syncopancy. You're not quite sure what's in the moment. Well,
right.
As you said, the story is set at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Melanie is a staffer for a candidate who sounds a whole lot like John Kerry. You were at that convention. Was I the only one who was there who did not have an affair with someone who was married? After reading the book and, you know, when you read the blog, was everybody doing that?
I think that the book exaggerates for effect the degree to which people fool around during a campaign, although it's definitely there. I mean, Washington is always a very interesting town and full of characters, but a campaign puts everyone's hormone levels, you know, through the roof. And feeling like you're at the center of the world can make you feel like you can do anything, and that includes doing things that maybe are illegal or immoral.
Okay, well, that also plays out in your book. There's trouble on the horizon for Melanie. As we said, she's the campaign staffer, as well as trouble for her candidate. Now, Melanie is having an affair with a married political writer. Her candidate, the John Kerry type, is under assault from a group calling itself the Citizens for Clear Heads. They've accused the candidate of being under mind control for wanting to share the wealth.
They say he'll redistribute wealth at the push of a button.
Ooh.
But whose finger is on that button?
So she and Melanie and her friend create this website in your book, Capitolette, to take attention off these looming scandals. And Capitolette is supposed to be a female writer who details her sexual exploits with various Washington types. A site becomes hugely popular. It was supposed to be a distraction, but it sort of gets out of control. Now, I want to stop the storyline there. Is that something you were familiar with, being somebody who was a blogger, you know, with your Wonkette?
Right. I mean, that's a part of the book that's taken from real life as well, in that there was a sort of minor sex scandal in Washington last year that involved a staffer for Senator Mike DeWine from Ohio, where she was blogging about her sexual exploits.
Her blog was called Washingtonienne. Mm-hmm.
And I helped bring her the notoriety that she gained. And what was really interesting about that to me, the most interesting thing about it, was that people were just convinced that I had engineered the entire thing. That surely, you know, it couldn't have happened by accident.
That you knew her name and wrote about her.
Right. And yet, of course, it actually was pretty much a random event. But it got me thinking that, well, what could you do that? Could you invent a fake sex blog? And why would you want to do that? Those kinds of questions, combined with being in on the scene during the Boston convention, you know, two great tastes that taste great together. I just sort of commingled those ideas, and here we are with a whole novel.
Well, and back to real life, though, your blog, Wonkette, as you said, revealed that it was Jessica Cutler, right, who was writing the Washingtonienne sort of sexual activity blog. It leaves the impression, as we talk about this, that all bloggers do in Washington is talk about who sleeps with whom.
And actually, I would say that's a very insignificant minority, or maybe a significant minority in the sense that they're the ones who get all the attention, or the ones that, that write about sex. Besides the Washingtonienne blog and my blog, I'm actually having trouble really thinking of another blog that would have that same, let's say, mix
of gossip. Well, then why did you go that route? Because you're married to a legitimate reporter? Is that okay if I say that?
Yes, he is. He's a very legitimate reporter.
Chris Layman of Congressional Quarterly. In fact, I think he's been on our program. Why didn't you, I mean, did you ever want to just go be a reporter?
I mean, well, the thing is, I tried very unsuccessfully to be a reporter for many years and was on my way out of the business.
You were going to quit?
I was going to quit. And then I got tapped to do the Wonkette. And
wait, who taps you?
The Wonkette is owned by, I love saying this phrase, eccentric British millionaire. Named Nick Denton, who's a blog publisher. He has several different blogs, including the name of the company is Gawker Media.
He's like your Charlie of Charlie's Angels.
Yes, and I see him about as much. He wanted me to basically do a DC version of Gawker, his New York blog.
Hmm.
He didn't quite get that. Gawker is a very, actually more gossip-focused than Wonkette, if you can believe it. Mm-hmm. I always want to challenge people whenever we talk about gossip in Wonkette to find the actual pieces of gossip in Wonkette, because there really isn't that much. And it's because I am very uncomfortable with the idea of ruining someone's life.
you've said, I don't mind ruining someone's day, but
right,
not their life.
Not their life. And so because I was sort of uncomfortable with a lot of dirt, I just talked dirty. At first, since no one knew who I was and there weren't any pictures of me anywhere, like I kind of created this character of like a slatternly housewife, you know, who is like watching her soaps and C-SPAN at the same time and eating bonbons and drinking gin.
Give an example for someone who hasn't read Wonkette, just a line or two of how you might address an issue.
For instance, the Abramoff scandal.
This is the lobbyist, of course, who's pled guilty.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so that, and the sort of game that people are playing with trying to figure out all the connections reminds me, like, when someone in a high school gets VD, like, gets a venereal disease, and however you have to kind of do the, like, well, who slept, like, did I slept with this person, who slept with this person, who slept with this person? And it's the same thing, only it's dirty money and not, you know, germs, let's say.
Well, but you have described the Washington, D.C. scene as being like a John Hughes movie, a high school.
Yeah, it's very much so. And I think it's like high school because everyone's really insecure and also very conscious of their status at all times. And also everyone's status is constantly changing. Mm. And also the other element that I think is important is the kinds of people that are attracted to Washington are the kinds of people that maybe in high school weren't the big men on campus. They weren't the people that really could control what was going to happen next. Whereas you come to Washington and the very skills that got these kids alienated in high school, you know, maybe being wonky and deliberate, are the things that are being rewarded in Washington.
Anna Marie Cox, who was the Wonkette, the person behind the political blog, The Wonkette Politics for People with Dirty Minds. She's now the author of a new fictional novel called Dog Days. It's centered around a fictional presidential campaign that sounds an awful lot like the last one. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And staying with Washington for just a second, in our live talk today about the Alito confirmation hearings, we were expecting Stuart Taylor of the National Journal, who's written favorably about Judge Alito. Stuart just called and apologized for missing our date. We forgive him. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please, don't stand us up. Join us again Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.